From KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. By 1919, much of Europe lay in ruins in the aftermath of World War I. But prior to that conflict, with three European empires ruled by the kingly cousins, most people thought war to be nearly impossible. This hour, historian Charles Emerson takes us through the year 1913 and the months leading up to the Great War. From the capitals of Europe to Washington, D.C., we'll view the world as it was 100 years ago in all its richness and complexity. We'll discuss how the seeds of modern globalization and imperial nationalism were forced together and how our world may not be so different today. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. The question that Charles Emerson's new book on the year 1913 raises is, was the world all that different from what it is today? Yes, we're talking 100 years ago and the year just before the Great War or World War I began. But the world was blossoming that year, interconnected in ways it had never been before. Industry was booming. The automobile was coming to the masses. China was awakening from centuries of slumber. Japan was establishing itself as a great power. Capitalism reigned. And yet, all that would not halt a world war that would claim 40 million lives and reshape the world landscape. Charles Emerson tells a story in 1913 in search of the world before the Great War. He's an Australian-born writer who lives in London and a senior research fellow at Chatham House, working on resource security issues, foreign policy, and global geopolitics. He's also the author of The Future History of the Arctic. Charles, so good to have you here. Welcome to Kansas City.
Thank you very much indeed, Steve.
And thanks for surviving a harrowing trip from the airport here, too. You're still in one piece.
Indeed, absolutely.
Not a bad thing. Well, this is a sprawl of a book that takes the reader from Washington to London to Paris to Constantinople. How did you wrap your arms around something quite as epic as the world on the eve of the Great War? Because you took a bite of the apple here and bites of about 22 other apples here, too, it seems to me.
Well, that's true. I mean, the great advantage I had was that I was only looking at 1 year. So in one sense, it was focused on those 12 months. But of course, you realize that as soon as you start looking at a 12-month period, all the things that happen in that year, you have to look back to understand how those things happen, why those things happen, and of course, why they were important. So I started off with a narrow focus. And then, of course, as things do, things ended up expanding. And in terms of the cities, which are really at the very much the core of the book,
yes, right.
There were a few cities that in 1913 you couldn't avoid writing about. You couldn't avoid writing about London,
sure,
or Berlin or Paris or Washington or New York. But I also wanted to move beyond that to provide a truly global portrait of the world.
Winnipeg.
Exactly.
Of all places.
Winnipeg. Well, I had a Canadian friend who essentially ran a guerrilla campaign for Winnipeg to be included. Mm. But the thing is that he was actually completely right for two reasons. First, that Winnipeg was this real boom town of the British Empire in 1913. It was viewed as being very much a city of the future. And indeed, if you go to Winnipeg now, you'll see a lot of very, very grand buildings built around that time, 1912, 1913. And of course, it's not quite so optimistic a place now. But at that time, it was viewed as being potentially one of the great cities of the 20th century.
Well, did you wind up visiting all these cities in the course of doing this book? Because if that's the case, I want your gig. I mean, that sounds pretty good.
Well, I would like that too. No, sadly, I couldn't visit all of them. I mean, mm-hmm. I have visited most of them at some point. But there were places I couldn't get to. I couldn't get to Tokyo, for example. Mm-hmm. I couldn't get to Buenos Aires, more's the pity. But I have been to most of them and was able to conduct a lot of research either in London or in other cities or remotely, of course.
Did it ever feel like the whole project was sort of becoming, too big, too sprawling?
Often.
Yeah.
Often it felt that the project was becoming difficult. But then you've got these great sources. You've got diaries, you've got newspapers, you've got great writing which already exists about the cities in this time. And I think that brings you right back to focus in the city at that time. And so the virtue of constructing it around cities was that you felt you were constantly coming back to real places. And yeah, that was great.
You know, a lot of readers, Charles, are going to assume that this is a book of gloomy foreboding. And what you find out reading this book is that's not the case at all. How surprising was that to you?
Well, it was one of the key reasons for writing the book. Yes. was not to write a book of gloomy foreboding, because very often when people think about the years before the First World War, the years before the Great War, very often they describe that world in terms of, you know, the onset of war, as if everyone was walking around with a time bomb or a clock ticking in their head,
right,
just waiting to go off in 1914. And the reality, of course, is that there were very other narratives. There were many other narratives around the world. There were different ideas of the future. And indeed, war was a possibility. People spoke about it. But they didn't think that the war that might happen would be the war that did happen. And many thought the war couldn't happen because the world was becoming more globalized. It was becoming more internationalized in terms of flows of people, trade, ideas, etc. So I very much wanted to pose a different view of the world in 1913.
And of course, you say all that, and myself, and I assume some of my listeners are thinking to themselves right now, well, you're describing the world today, and so you can't help but wonder, are you, you know, predicting here some of the same sort of cataclysmic results that you found 100 years ago?
Well, I think that's true, and I think it's unavoidable that there are some parallels between 1913 and 2013. And I don't want to draw those too strongly. I'm not suggesting that in 2013 we're just on the cusp of a new world war. But I think what is very important to recognize is that in 1913, an era of great globalization, many people believed that even if a war happened, that these processes of globalization, of the world being pulled closer together by technology,
mm-hmm,
that these were processes which would just continue. They couldn't stop.
Yeah.
And they did. And I think now, similarly, at a time of geopolitical tension, geopolitical shifts around the world, there is, a possibility of being a little bit lazy in the way we think about how the future is going to play out.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting. This is not a book that discusses very much at all about what caused the start of World War I. You really sort of strike a glancing blow to that and move on. But what's interesting to me about what you do say about the start of World War I is you say quite conclusively that we don't know how the damn thing started. It just started. And there are lots of different theories as to what happened here. But even today, 100 years later, we don't exactly know for sure.
We don't exactly know. And there are lots of books which are written about the lead up to World War I, if you like. Very few of them are called the reasons for World War I. They're often called things like origins, which implies a rather less clear line of causality between, you know, things that were in the air, things that were happening, and what actually ended up happening in 1914.
Yeah.
And there will be lots of books written about this. But, you know, very often they can't come to a neat conclusion because at the end of the day, it was something which happened and which even people at the time, many people, did not expect.
Yeah. And it just like firecrackers going off and we don't know exactly who struck the first match to light the first firecracker here.
Well, it's what, you know, if you want to point the finger of blame, then you can point the finger of blame at many different people, at, you know, the rise of nationalism, at individuals, at military staff. So you can at Germany, at some people pointed at Russia, some people at England. So, you know, it's possible to find lots of people to blame. I think what you generally find when there are so many potential candidates for, you know, the reasons or those who were responsible for it, is that probably it's a mixture of all of these.
And again, one other theme that you really strike throughout this book, and again, it's hard for folks maybe to wrap their arms around, but is it this idea that we're talking about 1913, we're talking about 100 years ago, and so many people look at those days as something out of this, you know, so far distant past, they can't even begin to relate to it. But one of your themes here is that the world in 1913 was incredibly modern. It was a world that we could, in many ways, relate to today.
Absolutely. I mean, the world of 1913 was already a world where you had automobiles and where you had, you know, energy geopolitics, which was associated with that. It was already a world where you had aeroplanes buzzing around in the sky. I mean, the first flight was only 10 years old, and yet by 1913, you'd actually had the first aerial bombing in the world. So, you know, the world was moving very, very quickly. There was a sense of acceleration, a sense of dynamism about it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, America was very much a part of that story as well.
Yeah. You know, whenever someone writes a book like this, again, that's as sprawling as this one is, I mean, I'm sure there's a place or two you'd have just died to have been for a few days to sort of get a sense of what was happening in that city at that time. Where would you like to have been? I'm sure London probably comes to mind pretty quickly.
Well, I'm from London, and in many respects, London hasn't necessarily changed that much between 1913 and 2013. So London actually probably wouldn't be on my list.
That's interesting.
You know, I think it'd be a lot of fun to be in Paris in 1913. I guess it's always fun to be
in Paris. Yeah.
I'd like to be in Constantinople in 1913, because that was a time when the capital of the Ottoman Empire was already in the middle of a war, actually, where it was looted. The Ottoman Empire lost all of its European territory. But I think that would be a place where you could really touch much, much older history. And those layers of history would be very, very present in a place like Constantinople, as they are today.
And where is Constantinople?
Istanbul.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it is today.
Istanbul, not Constantinople, as the song goes. I'm not going to sing it.
Charles Emerson is our guest. We're talking about the year 1913, In Search of the World Before the Great War. If you want to join our conversation, as always, you can do so. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address, UpToDate@KCUR.org, or you can tweet us @KCUR UpToDate. Again, our number, 816-235-2888. And I should point out that Charles Emerson will speak about the world in 1913 at 6 this evening at the National World War I Museum in downtown Kansas City. This is in conjunction with the museum's special exhibition, Road to War, that chronicles the run-up to the start of the war 100 years ago next year. But Charles again speaks tonight at 6 at the National World War I Museum. Set the world stage for us in 1913, Charles. I mean, who are the big players? What are they doing? What's the general zeitgeist of the time? What's happening back then?
Well, look, this is very much a world of empires. Mm-hmm. It's a world which has been at peace, more or less, for the past 100 years, or at least Europe has been more or less at peace for the last 100 years. It's a world which has been transformed by urbanization, and by industrialization in Europe, and also, of course, very much in the United States. The leading power of the age, without a doubt, is Britain, the United Kingdom.
But, and to look at a map of 1913 and to see exactly just how sprawling that empire was, I knew that, but to look at it on a map, it is pretty jaw-dropping.
It is pretty jaw-dropping, but actually British influence actually went even broader than that. If you went, for example, to a place like Buenos Aires in Argentina in 1913, you'd find an outlet of Harrods, the great London department store, in Buenos Aires in 1913. Huh. The head of the Argentinian Football Federation in 1913 was a Brit. So so Britain, actually quite a small country, had this tremendous global influence and really was the linchpin of what appeared to be a relatively stable global economic system.
Yeah,
but there were question marks about how long, you know, not the richest country in the world, could actually remain the linchpin of this global system. And rising powers, of course, in Germany and in Japan, Russia booming tremendously in 1913, and of course the United States in that year, which had become a greatly powerful, greatly wealthy economic power, but had not yet converted that into political power at all.
An isolationist country at that time.
Well, and understandably so. I mean, there were lots of people in the United States then who saw the Atlantic and the Pacific as being, you know, America's great protectors. America could develop separately from the rest of the world, you know, great domestic market as well. But I think increasingly they were politicians and business people who realized that actually America couldn't just sign off and be separate from the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And the United States was beginning to face the challenges of how it engaged with, yeah, you know, Mexico in the Civil War in Mexico. And, of course, several years later, it would be faced with the challenge of, you know, should it intervene or not in Europe? Was it acceptable to have a Europe which was run by the Germans?
This country had a new president in 1913.
Yes, Woodrow Wilson, mm-hmm, talking about the new freedom. And, indeed, many of the issues which were discussed in the United States in 1913 are familiar today. Mm-hmm. There was a big discussion about the relationship between Wall Street and Main Street. People railing about big corporations and how big corporations were squeezing the life out of smaller business and innovations across the United States.
Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
But the U.S. was not yet. It was sort of halfway between being a nation of villages and small towns So halfway between being that and being a city of great cities. So on the one hand, you have the skyscrapers of New York City. The Woolworth Building goes up in 1913. On the other hand, you know, Washington, D.C. is still a relatively small place. It's very much a city of the South. It's only 50 years since the end of the Civil War. So, you know, this is a real transition period in American history as well.
And just to put things in perspective, that same year, 1913, there was, what, a 50th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg held right here in this country. Lots of old vets getting together talking about that battle.
And it's quite striking. If you can find photographs extraordinarily of the 50-year reunion in Gettysburg, at which Woodrow Wilson spoke on July the 4th. And of course, he was the first elected Southern president since the Civil War. So this was a big deal. And you look at these black and white pictures of the Confederate soldiers and the Union soldiers, and you know what? Some of them don't look that old.
Yeah.
They really don't.
Yeah.
And there were 50,000 of them in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. So it really wasn't so long ago.
Who are some of the other two or three other leading figures on the world stage in 1913? People.
Well, one would be, I think, Kaiser Wilhelm in Germany, who's this rather fascinating, infuriating character. The German Kaiser, he's been on the throne for 25 years in Germany. He's really an authoritarian. He wants to be loved. Really, he wants to be loved. I think that's what it comes down to. And he wants to make Berlin, the capital city of Germany, to be the grandest city in the world. His English grandmother was, of course, Queen Victoria. He looks over at Britain, which is, of course, the preeminent world power, and he kind of wants Germany to be a bit like Britain, but just a little bit better. he's an infuriating and I think actually quite complex character as well. So he's one. Another character who I look at in the book and I find fascinating is Gandhi, who of course later would be the leader of the Indian independence movement. But in 1913, he's a British educated lawyer in South Africa, leading a campaign against discriminatory taxation in that part of the world. And this is really where he gets his start. So if you like, his rise towards being the leader of the Indian independence movement actually starts not in India at all, but in South Africa. So this, you know, there's a very, very wide cast of characters, as you would imagine. But those two they're pretty interesting.
I want to talk about Vienna in just a moment. I want to get some phone calls here first. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. UpToDate at KCUR.org is our email address. Charles Emerson is our guest. We're talking about 1913, his new book, 1913, In Search of the World Before the Great War. Let's go to Richard from Olathe. Richard, you're on UpToDate. So nice to have you. Good morning. You there, Richard?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Richard.
Yes. I'm curious what your guest would comment on the development of the United States Federal Reserve in 1913 and how it possibly worked in with prior to World War One and even after World War One. Was the conception of the Federal Reserve I can't think of the right word, maybe an issue of concern? Was it something of great importance? Did it have a big change in the banking and the corporate system at the time?
But we just did a show on Woodrow Wilson a few weeks ago. Scott Berg was here with his new book. And I think, you know, one of his great achievements was the founding of the Fed, right?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And that this sort of goes back a bit to what I was saying earlier about the United States in 1913 not being a fully formed nation, if you like, being an adolescent nation in some respects. And the Federal Reserve, the foundation of the Federal Reserve, the establishment of the Federal Reserve in 1913 was one of these, I think, crucial markers, actually, to the United States becoming a more centralized nation in some respects, but also becoming a country which could convert economic power ultimately into political power.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead, Richard. Anything else?
No, that's about it. What about the Federal Reserve as we have it nowadays? Is there any correlation between what it was at that time and what it is now?
Hmm. Well, of course, in 1913, you had to see what it was replacing. I mean, America had had a financial crisis in 1907, which had essentially been settled in the offices of J.P. Morgan in New York City, where J.P. Morgan the most wealthy and most powerful financier of his age, had gathered all these other Wall Street types into his office and basically forced them to put more liquidity into the system. So it was very much focused around private individuals. And what the Federal Reserve did, of course, was to put to mix that up a bit with representatives of the state.
So institutionalized that system.
Institutionalize it, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Richard, I'm glad you called. Thank you. Again, our number 816-235-2888 and our email address update@kcur.org. What was happening in Vienna? Because all kinds of incredible world players are sort of gathering in Vienna very quietly in 1913.
Well, Vienna in 1913 is the capital of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which is this very odd empire that's been built up over centuries by, you know, dynastic marriages, you know, who's died when, you know, battles in the mists of time, and as a result of which the empire is a sort of rather a sort of higgledy-piggledy construction, if I can say
that's
that.
It's
a place where, you know, in different parts of the empire, people drive on different sides of the road. It's a very odd construct. And people speak many different languages. But it's also a place, therefore, which has, it attracts a lot of people from outside. And so in Vienna in 1913, you have Trotsky, you have Hitler. You have Stalin visiting.
Right.
You have Freud. You have Wittgenstein. You have. I mean, it is an extraordinary city, but probably not a terribly hopeful city, because many people in Vienna in 1913 feel that power and wealth has kind of leached to these other European cities. Berlin is seen as the great German speaking upstart.
Yeah.
In the German speaking world, a far more dynamic capital, far more dynamic economy in Germany than in Austria-Hungary. But Vienna's an interesting place, and I try to recapture not only the sense of what's going on culturally and politically in Vienna at that time, but also the atmosphere. I mean, even if you go to Vienna now, you go to some of the cafes in Vienna, they really haven't terribly much changed.
And you must have just utterly immersed yourself in that era, in that history. How did you go about researching stuff 100 years ago and in these different cities? How did you get yourself so geared into the world of 1913, as you clearly did, Charles?
Well, it was very much it was immersive. I can't go back in time, but I can do the next best thing, which is to read what people were writing at that time. I mean, one thing I did, for example, for each of the cities was to just go and find a newspaper for each of those cities and go through it for the full 365 days of the year and actually get a sense of what was on people's minds. And the interesting thing is
for the entire year for each city?
For the entire year. I mean, obviously, I wasn't reading absolutely every single single article.
Yeah.
But I think the point is you can actually get a quite good idea of what the main concerns were of people at that time just from reading the newspapers. And very often those would be quite different from those that we might expect. In other words, the possibility of a big international war. I mean, certainly that was present, but people worried about other things. In Britain, for example, in London, there was much more coverage of what was happening in Ireland, home rule in Ireland, and the possibility of a civil war in Britain or of the suffragettes campaign. Or if you look through U.S. newspapers, again, the focus was very much on, you know, on nation building at home, certainly not on the possibility of war abroad. So that was a good start.
And at what point during the course of 1913 did you begin to sense tension that could result in a spark that led to this conflagration that became World War One?
Well, you know, it's always there. It's always there in the background. I mean, there is war in the Balkans in 1913, so it's happening on the European continent. But at the same time, the big powers, the big European powers, are getting together and trying to resolve it. Britain and Germany are coming really quite close in 1913. In May of that year, there is a royal wedding in Berlin where the daughter of the Kaiser is married.
It's a wonderful scene. Yeah.
And you know, you have the Kaiser of Germany, you have the Tsar of Russia, you have the King of England. And that was actually the last time those three would ever meet. But no one would have thought that at the time, or few people would have thought it at the time. So
and there was such a rush, you point out, to get newsreels about their meeting.
Yes.
You know, and get that film, you know, rushed back to the States where it could be shown in theaters and, you know, shown so people could see this great meeting.
Well, this is, of course, I mean, cinema is a wonderful aspect of modernity in 1913. Mm-hmm. And cinema, not just in you know, having, you know, short slapstick movies, but film as a propaganda tool as well. I mean, Woodrow Wilson makes a campaign movie in the 1912 presidential elections in the United States. In Russia in 1913, Tsar Nicholas II is celebrating 300 years of the Romanov dynasty, mm-hmm. And there are films made to celebrate this, of course.
Yeah.
And yes, the idea of these films being rushed by fast train and fast steamer. To be shown, you know, it is a world which isn't so foreign to our own.
Yeah, and even when the Duke is assassinated, and there's this moment when you sense, and a lot of people point to that moment as the spark that sets off World War One. Was there a sense right away that something was terribly, terribly wrong that was going to result in what became World War One?
Well, remember, there'd been assassinations of very substantial political figures before, of presidents and princes. So it wasn't necessarily clear that this assassination would lead to a great European conflagration. In fact,
so
at the time,
you don't read the papers at that time and think, "Uh-oh, here we go."
Well, you know, it might be front page news for one day, but it wasn't front page news necessarily the following day in all newspapers. So, it was of course, you know, a serious event. The heir to the throne of one of the great and oldest European powers is assassinated in Sarajevo, and essentially by suicide bombers, effectively. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a big event. It'll be a big event now. But a lot of European leaders are on holiday. Not all of them rush back. Why should they? The diplomats will deal with it. There've been crises before. There've been crises where people have said, "Oh, well, you know, this is the one." But people have dealt with it. So why should this time be any different? And I think that great fundamental human, you know, human question: why should this time be any different? Yeah. That I think was very present in 1914.
What was the date of that assassination? What part of the year was it?
It was in June 1914.
So halfway in 14. So you're a year out.
Yes, that's right.
It's in 14 instead of 13. Okay. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here with Charles Emerson about his new book, 1913, In Search of the World Before the Great War. We'll take your questions at 816-235-2888 and at our email address, UpToDate@KCUR.org. Again, Charles Emerson speaks about the world in 1913 at 6 this evening at the National World War I Museum. More information about that on our website, KCUR.org. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed Friday's discussion of horror movies with the DVD gurus, you can find that and the weekend to-do list. Just go to kcur.org. Tomorrow on the show, Pulitzer Prize winner David Finkel joins us to talk about the impact military deployments have on families, especially when soldiers return home traumatized after serving overseas. Much of his book looks at Fort Riley out in the middle of Kansas. We'll visit with journalist David Finkel tomorrow on the show. This hour, our guest is Charles Emerson. We're talking about the year 1913, 100 years ago, the last year of peace before the Great War begins, World War I. Charles Emerson's new book, 1913, In Search of the World Before the Great War. We're also joined now by Doran Cart. He's a senior curator at the National World War I Museum. The museum has a new exhibit titled Road to War, which explores the pivotal world events leading up to World War I. And Doran, nice to have you. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
What were some of the big pivotal events that begin to precipitate World War I? What does your exhibit show here?
Well, of course, we start with the 1904 because that was really the year of the Russo-Japanese War, and which was really probably the most modern war up to that date, with the use of technology, with the use of fleets. And
that war was fought where?
That primarily was fought in the east, mm-hmm. in the Far East, and it really was a territorial dispute more than anything. And then we don't really say that's what led to it. That was just one of the factors that were really coming out of this whole idea of world imperialism and colonialism. And, you know, because we often think that Americans really didn't have any involvement in this, but we were true imperialists.
In what sense?
In that we were trying to control the Philippines and going in to fight basically a country that was completely different religion than ours and with people who really didn't understand why we were there. And we were there basically because of the outcome of the Spanish-American War of 1898. And so we also show that in the exhibit. And one of the players in that, American players, was a fellow who then would play the pivotal role in the American effort in World War I, which was General John J. Pershing.
Hmm.
And, of course, he was the ground commander in the Philippines at two different times. And so he learned in that capability of guerrilla warfare, really. And
he would wind up in Kansas City in 1920 at the dedication of the National the Liberty Memorial that we see today.
Right. He came to the dedication along with the four other main Allied leaders who were the only time they were all five together was in Kansas City at the dedication of the site of the Liberty Memorial.
What else does your exhibit show in terms of the run-up to the Great War?
Well, one thing that we really concentrated on, this came from an object that was donated to the museum, which was a servant's uniform of a very important Bavarian family. And it this whole idea of the haves and the have-nots, the people who had nothing really because all the power and money was concentrated in the hands of the few.
Charles was talking about that in our first half this morning, right?
And so we emphasize that. And so we show the fancy dress that was worn by people and then basically the lack of dress, if you want to say, of the peoples in the colonies in Africa and in the Philippines. And so that's another area that really doesn't get a lot of play.
Was that a factor in the start of the war?
Well, of course, it was when you really get into this development of nationalism and why are we being subjugated to colonial rule when we have our own languages, we have our own cultures, we have our own ways of dealing with things in our society. So why is somebody from Europe telling me what to do?
Mm-hmm.
And so while it might not be everybody always wants to make a direct line.
Right.
And while it might not be a direct line, it is a contributing factor to people understanding that they can be different. They could have societal differences. They could have cultural and language differences. And an emperor or a king 2,000 miles away really doesn't mean a whole lot to them.
Yeah. We're visiting with Doran Clark. He's a senior curator at the National World War I Museum. Your exhibit, Road to War, we were talking with Charles Emerson in our first half, and of course he's still with us here. This notion that the start of the war, you know, remains a mystery, even 100 years later. Charles points out in his book that it's difficult to point to one moment as the single cause. You seem to be suggesting the same thing here as well. Talk to me about that. What's your sense of what actually started World War I?
Well, it really becomes the case of one country wanting to tell another country what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really want to boil it down to simplistic terms, which again, I don't think I can do, but when after the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand by a Bosnian Serb nationalist, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, of course, blames Serbia for this. And when they really say, look, we're going to come in and we're going to take over your legal processes and we're going to tell you how to run your country, then it's not a real popular thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens is, of course, you have all these entangling alliances. And so
between different nations.
Between different
you're talking
nations.
About. Yeah.
And so you think about this is Serbia's big friend is Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Russia doesn't want the Austro-Hungarian Empire telling Serbia what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, then Germany doesn't want Russia telling the Austro-Hungarian Empire what to do. So, you know, it's a It's a very much a potboiler, in use of contemporary terms, atmosphere. But as it was alluded to or said earlier, it was regarded as a diplomatic kind of effort at first. The problem that really, when it gets into it, is when the nation started mobilizing. And when they mobilized their troops, you didn't have to declare war. The mobilization was seen as a declaration of war. And so
just because it was an aggressive
– It was an aggressive act. It was seen as an aggressive act. And again, I'm not nearly the scholar to say, you know, that one thing that caused World War I, and you come to the museum in our introductory film, we really say these are factors – and all added together or subtracted part from or whatever, these contributed to this. But really, what was the explosion? It's really hard to tell. I think if anybody really claims they know the answer, I don't think they've done the research.
Because it's so multi-layered and so complicated.
Because of that, and you have the family ties, you have the leading houses are all interrelated. And you have that they were trained in the same manners, in the same military efforts. And so to really say, oh, well, you know, there was an invasion or this was this that really caused the war, you can't really. I mean, you can add all these things up. And, well, and like this whole idea of some part of society had electricity, they had cars, they had incredible railroad transportation. Others were still living in the dark. And so when this happens, maybe this is a chance for them to get out of the dark.
You're talking about countries, just multiple countries
multiple
here.
Multiple countries.
That was the way of standard of living.
You know, it's not just one guy, pulling a pistol out.
Yeah. And along those lines, Charles, Mary writes us this at UpToDate at KCUR.org. Did the social inequality of nations in 1913 at the time have any similarity to social inequality in the situation we see in developed nations today?
Not only in not only in developing nations, also in nations such as the United States. If you look at actually, believe it or not, income inequality in the United States in 2013 is the same as it was in 1913.
No kidding.
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary stuff. And in some European countries, you get the rise of socialism around this time, and that's a factor which, for example, in Germany, means that some on the right of politics say, look, what we really need is a short, sharp war. We need a victory. And this victory will cement the state in politics at home. So you know there is a lot of tumult around the world on these issues.
I was going to say, how much commentary sort of was out there in 1913 about this idea of social inequality? Because it certainly is an issue today. And as a guy who sort of covers politics for a living, I've always been sort of surprised that we don't see more of that talk today about this sort of what the stats tell us to be really this very grand set of distinctions now between the haves and the have-nots.
Well, of course, in the United States at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, people worried that maybe the U.S. was becoming more like Europe. Maybe the U.S. was going to develop a sort of moneyed aristocracy, the Rockefellers and the Morgans, etc. And one other very important element of it, which I'd like to come back to, because we mentioned empire, and people often think, you know, America doesn't do empire, the U.S. doesn't do empire, but the U.S. was doing empire around this time in the Philippines and Cuba and elsewhere,
and aggressively so, it sounds like.
Well, I mean, the war in the Philippines was an extremely hard one to win. And also, if you look across the Pacific at Japan, I mean, you know, 50 years previously, Japan had been a hermit kingdom. 60 years previously, closed off to the world. By 1913, it's a great power, and the United States is beginning to wake up to the possibility of conflict. In fact, in 1913, there's a land law in California which excludes Japanese from owning land, and the Secretary for the Navy provides advice to the president that maybe the Japanese will actually consider war over this. So you get a sense that the U.S. which previously would like to have thought of itself as being inviolate, protected by these two huge oceans from the rest of world affairs, actually it finds itself almost against its will, being drawn further and further and further into global politics, sometimes kicking and screaming, but nonetheless being drawn into it.
And of course, the story of how Woodrow Wilson actually decided, went from something of an isolationist foreign policy in term one to something dramatically different in term two, and willing America to enter this war and save civilization, as it turns out, is a pretty dramatic story in and of itself.
Absolutely. I mean, he wins the election in 1916 saying, you know, we won't go to war. In 1917, the U.S. goes to war. So there is a story here about the transfer of global leadership from Britain, which was really the preeminent power over the 19th century, and who's going to take up the mantle of responsibility in the 20th century.
Yeah.
And actually, for the first 30 or 40 years of the 20th century, although the United States is the richest country in the world, it hasn't yet done that.
Again, we're talking with Charles Emerson about his book, 1913, In Search of the World Before the Great War. The title says it all. What was happening in the world in 1913, just a year later, the world engulfed in World War I? Let's go back to some calls at 816-235-2888. Let's go to Mike from Shawnee. Mike, thanks for calling.
Hey, good morning. Great show. What a fascinating subject. My quick comment, the entangling alliances that Doran talked about, I mean, we have the same thing in a way today with the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. I wondered what your guests would think about that. And then my other quick comment is the inequality of wealth today. There's a great expression of that. There's a film by Robert Reich, playing at the Tivoli, I think, still.
Right.
Called Inequality for All, and if you haven't seen it, it's very illuminating.
So how do you compare, Charles, the tangled alliances of 1913 to things like what we see in NATO today?
For me personally, I would say that NATO is quite different. In 1913, you have a series of alliances in Europe, and you have some question marks about exactly what those alliances mean, particularly what Britain's relationship to those alliances means. And one can argue, actually, that's one factor which leads to war breaking out. Mm-hmm. The fact that people don't know whether Britain will enter the European continent on one side or the other. That may actually be a factor which encourages people to see how far they can go on the European continent. And it's similar to NATO in this regard. I believe that if the United States pulls back from NATO, that will be very, very dangerous in Europe to some degree, but also I think in world politics. It's very important to have countries that are prepared to commit. And I think actually you can view alliances as being as much factors of stability as factors of instability.
And of course, President Wilson tried to get the League of Nations set up before his term of office ended and failed. One of the great failed legacies of his presidency.
Absolutely. I mean, the fascinating story of the 1920s, of course, is the failure of not even the 20s, from 1919, is the failure of that peace. Actually,
it may have killed him.
Well, and as an outsider, actually looking now at American politics, one thing which frightens me is a strain of American isolationism in foreign policy, which I think has, if you like, always been there. But as somebody from outside America, somebody who thinks that America needs to have a forward-leaning stance in foreign policy around the world, that's basically generally a good thing. I worry about America pulling back from the world.
Mike, I hope that helps.
Yeah, hey, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you, Mike.
Watch the movie if you haven't seen it, Steve. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Mike. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, update@kcur.org. Doran, before I let you go, obviously next year being the centennial of the start of World War I, a big year for your museum, how are you guys gearing up? How ready are you to go to tackle what's going to be this avalanche of renewed interest in the Great War?
Well, I think that we're very aggressively looking at programming, at special exhibitions, and at traveling exhibitions, and we're going to have a very strong online presence that we haven't had before. We're also looking at it that this will be an opportunity for us to expand our collection, because the museum started collecting in 1920, and we're still very actively collecting today, and we see that this will be a time where people will regard us as the perfect repository from materials. We collect all the belligerents, all 36 nations, and so we're really looking at that as us being the center of the acquisitions and the scholarship of World War One and the centennial.
So to what extent do you guys see attendance rising, interest rising, the whole thing as we near 2014?
Well, I think we're already seeing that to a certain extent. And with our the exhibition, The Road to War, that is a lead-in to the centennial, we're seeing a lot of interest. People have a lot of interest in anniversary kind of activities. And so, you know, we're really we're not taking advantage of that, but we're building upon that interest. And, of course, whenever we get a new scholarly publication like Charles' book, then that also helps increase the interest in the museum.
Okay. 816-235-2888. You know, Charles, the world, as we've pointed out here, rapidly changing in 1913. Henry Ford's production line is being put to use. Planes, trains, and automobiles were becoming more prominent in everyday life. How much anxiety did all that produce, you know, as a result of the modernization of the world at that time? A lot of anxiety. How much excitement? Can you quantify those kinds of things?
Well, you again, if you look at the newspapers, on the back pages of a lot of newspapers in the U.S. and in Europe, you'll find advertisements for all kinds of sort of cures, you know, trusses for men that are supposed to give them greater vitality in life. You know, lots of discussion about, you know, people who are stressed and anxiety, you know, cures for headaches, you know, vitamins to give people energy. So, you know, of course you see these things today as well, right? But actually, just as a side, one of the pictures I use often to describe the world in 1913 is a brochure from an around the world cruise in 1913. And on this wonderful ship, the SS Cleveland, there was a gym. So, like today,
$600 or something.
$600.
Yeah, I saw that. I was interested in that price, by the way.
But the best thing about it is if you went to the gym on this ship, they didn't have an exercise bike; they had an exercise horse.
I saw that. Yes.
So that's, you know, that's 1913, sort of a bit like today, but also still a bit different.
still a little bit of acknowledgement of the more recent past. Absolutely. Doug from Overland Park. Doug, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I am really fascinated by this book Mr. Emerson's written.
Thank you very much indeed.
I'm a big fan of The Guns of August by Barbara Tuchman. A great book about the month of August.
Guns of August, yeah.
In 1914, and I'm wondering if you might have been influenced to write about the year 1913 prior to the war after having read Barbara Tuchman's book.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't say I grew up with Barbara Tuchman, but certainly I read Barbara Tuchman at a young and tender age, and she's a fantastic historian, fantastic writer. But she's very much focused on Europe and the United States. And what I wanted to do in my book was to go beyond that and look at Africa and Asia and, you know, Shanghai, Tokyo, and see what's happening in the broader world. But certainly she is a great writer, a classic.
You know, who were the rabble-rousers of the time that were sort of getting things stirred up in terms of nationalism and that kind of thing? Who would you point to, Charles, that sort of was trying to stir things up around the globe back then?
Well, I mean, if you're looking for rabble-rousers, you can find them in any time in pretty much any country. Interestingly, these days we tend to think of Germany as being more nationalistic in 1913 than any other country in Europe. But in fact, at the time in 1913, if you wanted to find the truly rabid nationalists, you probably would have gone to France, I think.
And seen what?
Well, you know, France, 40 years previously, had lost Alsace and Lorraine. These two provinces in eastern France had been lost to Germany. The statues of Alsace and Lorraine, the Place de la Concorde in Paris, were draped in black. There were people who said that, you know, France should certainly go to war, you know. The revanchists said, you know, France should go to war in order to claim these provinces back. They didn't actually speak for a very large section of the French population. They didn't actually even speak for the people of Alsace and Lorraine, as is often the case. Those people, they kind of wanted to be left alone. They didn't want to be the cause of a great war. But similarly, it's interesting the way that we write the history after it's happened. In Britain and the United States, we tend to view Germany as being the more nationalistic country. We actually view Germany as being for example, a more anti-Semitic country than France. In fact, the language of Zionism in 1913 was German, and the headquarters of that organization were in Berlin. Einstein was moving. And so, you know, the world looks very, very different when you look at it in a particular year, at a particular time, rather than writing the history afterwards.
Hey, how much did World War One change the planet as we know it? How was the world different at the end of the war compared to how it was before? Was there that big of a difference?
It was a huge difference. I mean, it accelerated a large number of social changes within countries. You know, women getting the vote, for example, happened, I think, more quickly than otherwise might have been the case.
1920, I think, right?
Yeah, and in this country as well.
Yeah.
But I think what it does, actually, the most crucial thing, apart from destroying several empires, bringing about the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, the rise of communism, is you get a sense, in 1913, there's a sense that Europe is the center of the world. It is the supreme global civilization. By the end of the war, you know, that's just not tenable anymore. And there's a Chinese writer who describes, who used to be a great fan of Europeanization, of Westernization, and he says, has it really come down to this, selfishness and slaughter? And I think that's true all over the world. Europe is no longer the moral high ground.
And how does Europe react to that?
Well,
how quickly does it recognize it?
But Europe is incredibly introspective after the First World War, and why not? You've gone from a great booming era of the late 19th and early 20th century to a world where there are a huge number of people walking around the streets who've lost limbs. It is a different world.
Charles Emerson's new book, 1913, In Search of the World Before the Great War. It's been an absolute pleasure, Charles. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And again, you can see and hear Charles tonight at 6 at the National World War I Museum. More information about that event and all of our broadcasts, kcur.org. I want to thank Doran Cart again, a senior curator at the National World War I Museum. Doran, thanks for coming in and thanks for your time today.
You're welcome, Steve.
You bet. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the show, journalist and Pulitzer Prize winner David Finkel joins us to talk about the impact military deployments have on families, especially when soldiers return home traumatized after serving overseas. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Cody Newell. For KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.